It's enough to make you fall in love with salt. Although everyone's trying to make us fall out of love with it. Sodium and chlorine get a look in that song, but not potassium. Potassium has elbowed its way in, onto our dinners. However, quote, switching to potassium-enriched salt is feasible in a way that cutting salt intake is not. That was from the ABC, reporting on research out of the University of New South Wales. This has been in the news this past week. If you have high blood pressure, you can try the wall squats we mentioned a couple of weeks ago, and that's been downloaded by thousands and thousands of people. But you can also, say the authors of this new study, opt for potassium over sodium in your salt. To talk about this and about the supplements that are claimed to improve cognition and memory is Dr. Ali Hill from the Department of Human Nutrition at Otago University. Morena, Ali.
Morena.
Can we do salt 101? How did potassium come to be at the table when we always thought salt was sodium chloride?
Yeah, absolutely. So salt is sodium chloride, but it can also have other things into it, added into it, which sort of depends on how it's made. So sea salt, for example, you make by evaporating salt water, which means that it has other minerals in it like magnesium, calcium, and potassium. Whereas table salt, you make by processing salt deposits. And this processing gets rid of these minerals. And because of that, we have to add things to it, back to it, like anti-caking agents such as potassium added to it as well.
Yes. With the brand we buy at home, a very common one, the ingredients state anti-caking agent, salt, and potassium iodate. So how much sodium is there and how much potassium?
So the sodium levels are about 40% by weight, which is the same as sea salt as well. But you might actually... This is by weight, so the amount that you add could be different. So if you're adding it by teaspoons, for instance, then you're going to have less sodium on your with your sea salt. But if you add a teaspoon of regular salt, you're going to have more just because of the fact that the crystals are bigger in the sea salt. But then again, we tend to add it to taste or judging on how it looks as well, certainly. So it might not be the case that it's a kind of different level. It's kind of hard to say exactly how much is in there because it depends on how much you add.
Well, these researchers recommended that guideline bodies such as the World Health Organization review their recommendations about the use of potassium-rich salts. So can we feel a lot better about using iodized table salt with potassium?
I don't know that I'd say a lot better. I mean, it's one of those things that I keep saying, you know, it's everything in moderation. So iodized salt is good and it's better than non-iodized. And potassium rich, the idea here is that it helps lower your blood pressure by and also make sure that the fluid balance in our cells is right. But again, if you have too much of it, it can be an issue. The thing about nutrition, though, is it's really individual. So whereas one person might do really well with potassium-rich salt, if their sodium intake's too high, somebody else might do worse. And you might even do better looking at other sources of potassium, like fruit and veg, as boring as it sounds. But the benefit of these is that they also have more fiber in it and less sodium. So again, it kind of comes to the same point, but through a different way, really. And if you have problems with your kidneys, that means that you can't remove the excess potassium, your levels can build up and that can also be quite dangerous. So again, it's not really something that you do. So I don't know about you would feel it's a better move for everybody, but it's definitely something to consider.
Okay, so it's a generalization to say that if you have high blood pressure, you should set out in search of potassium-enriched salt.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's going to be other things like changing your activity levels and other types of foods that you eat that will also be beneficial. It's not really as simple as just saying switch to this salt and you'll be fine.
It gets even more complicated, doesn't it? Iodized salt is essential for us in New Zealand. You have mentioned this before yourself, that New Zealand soils don't bequeath us with enough in our vegetables, enough iodine in our vegetables. But evidently we're turning away from common or garden salt and embracing pink salts and salt flakes and such. But I saw a study that analysed the mineral contents of various types of salts, including pink Himalayan salt and regular table salt. And pink Himalayan contains more calcium, potassium, magnesium and iron. Is that what you were saying before? So actually, we should mix our salts up a bit, ideally, too.
Well, If you're going to have salt, then yes, potentially it's better to have different types of salt. But I think ultimately we're probably having too much salt anyway. And we're, the better thing that we should be doing is reducing it and using herbs and spices for flavor instead. And again, if we've got a wide and kind of broad and balanced diet, then it's not really going to make a huge difference anyway.
Dr. Ali Hill is with us. I think I've asked you this before. Research out of the California Institute of Technology says we crave salt just as we crave water. Quote, bottom line, your body will tell you when it's got a hankering for salt, so let your cravings be your guide. I don't know if you agree with that, but it does underscore a perennial problem facing health authorities. I mean, people, obviously, because of human nature, want alcohol, they want nicotine, they want salt, they want sweetness, etc., etc., Ellie.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know that we fully understand cravings and where they come from. But there's something called pica, which you usually get in pregnancy, but you can see in kids. And this is where you crave and start to eat things that aren't food. They don't have nutritional value, so things like rocks and crayons and bits of metal and stuff. So again, that's a really good example of where following your craving is not necessarily a good idea. And another one is just coming back to that craving water thing that you were talking about. So a good example of this is when you are thirsty, so you start to kind of get this craving for water. But the thing about this is that when you're thirsty, you're already dehydrated. So in sports nutrition, for instance, we talk about drinking before you get thirsty. So listening to a craving might not be the right thing for you. But again, we need more research really to understand these.
Just a change of topic, in GQ, the magazine, everyone is talking about the 30-30-30 diet, but what is it? What is it, please, Ellie? Is it any use, this new 30-30-30 thing?
Yeah, so I don't know that everyone's talking about it. I had to
No,
look it up, but
same.
it is, yeah, it's where you eat 30 grams of protein within 30 minutes of waking up, and then you do 30 minutes of low intensity exercise. And the idea being that it helps to control your blood sugar better because of the fact that you're having protein rather than a carbohydrate when you for your breakfast. But then again, also different carbohydrates will affect your blood sugar differently anyway. So it's quite a simplification of doing it. But the theory really is that you don't feel as hungry because you've got protein and you don't get as many cravings. So it could help with weight loss. It sort of also depends on what you eat. So you could have something that is high protein but also high sugar. And again, that's not necessarily going to have the same impact. But being more active can definitely help, as we could keep talking about.
Yeah. All right. So you wait half an hour. That's the first 30. The third 30 is the moderate exercise afterwards. And in the middle is the protein. So I take your point about lots of things you can eat have added sugar and stuff. So it's essentially eggs, nuts, and what else?
30 grams of protein is probably about a scoop of protein powder or a scoop and a half. Now, I wouldn't necessarily recommend going straight to the protein powder because it's not going to have the same nutrients that regular food is going to have. So you're not going to get the same bang for your buck, really. But in terms of eggs, it's something like 8 hard-boiled eggs or 4 slices of bacon or a cup and a half of tofu. So it's quite a lot to eat, I think, in one go.
It says it helps with weight loss. Can you see much of a help? I suppose any healthy regime helps with weight loss, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing about weight loss is that it happens when you eat less than you burn. So if you're being more active, you're going to be burning more calories. So it's going to be easier to lose weight. And as I'm sure I keep saying, it's quite a simplification because it depends very much on what else you're doing the rest of the day. So if you're having your 30 grams of protein, you're doing a moderate exercise, but then you sit on the couch and you eat lollies, then it's not going to be the same impact. So it's a nice idea, but I think it's not necessarily the answer that we need.
Thank you. And the last topic, a study out of King's College London, so it's not some obscure university in the middle of nowhere, reckons daily fibre supplements improve brain function, including memory, in older adults in 12 weeks. And the supplements were a prebiotic called inulin and FOS. I'll let you pronounce FOS, what it stands for. So I thought this was really interesting. Are these supplements readily available here? And what's your opinion of their efficacy and of this study, please?
Yeah, so FOS stands for fructooligosaccharides, which doesn't really roll off the tongue, so we'll probably stick with FOS. But the idea with here is that it's a type of prebiotic. So prebiotics are the food that the good bacteria eat. So if you hear about probiotics being really good for you, that's the good bacteria. So this is their food source, basically. And it was an interesting study. So what they did is they had twins over the age of 60, and for 12 weeks they had either a protein supplement and did resistance exercises, or they had that, and then on top of that they had inulin as well. And the idea here was that they were looking at improving muscle function. Now, this is a really important point, because the main measurement that they looked at for this study is chair rise time. Now, chair rise time is really good, because it's seeing how quickly you can get out of a chair. This is something that we do every day, so it's probably more applicable than if we were doing kind of like how much weight they can lift, for instance, because, you know, not a lot of 60-year-olds necessarily do that, but the majority of people will be getting out of chairs during the day.
Right.
But the interesting thing is that this was their primary outcome. So this is the thing that they are looking at, the main thing they're doing. And the memory tasks and the cognitive function were the secondary ones. Now, the issue here is that the secondary outcomes, you can't necessarily prove something with this study, but it can help you to kind of develop a theory or a hypothesis, or help you interpret things and things like that. So an example of that, really, I suppose, is that I went to the Pink concert the other week, and the majority of people there were female, but that doesn't necessarily mean that all women like Pink. I mean, they should, but it doesn't necessarily mean that that happens. So, you know, this is quite a good example of you can find things by accident, I suppose, but the study is not designed to be able to prove it, in inverted commas. So I don't know that I'd rush out and buy these supplements. They are available, but you can also get them in food. So things like wheat, onions, bananas, leek, and artichokes are really good sources of inulin. And so I'd probably, again, go for the food first approach. So go for food rather than buying supplements, because if nothing else, it will add to your fiber intake and give you a broader range of nutrients as well.
Right. So when they say they found the fiber supplements led to significant changes in the gut microbiome composition, you would observe those changes with the foods you've just mentioned, actually, that, as a matter of course.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do have to say that some of those foods can be quite triggering if you have IBS, but so probably not the best kind of things to do. But yeah, you probably expect to see changes in your gut anyway from just by having that.
Very good. Thank you again for your expertise, as always, and for joining us on Sunday morning.
No problem. Thank you.